Here I sit, an Israelite, a member of the chosen people of Yahweh, to be separate from other nations, a priesthood, a holy people. I always thought that this meant that I wasn't to associate with other nations, that any foreign rule around us or over us was against Yahweh's plan, that it was only within the deliverance and the freedom of Israel that Yahweh could fulfill his purposes. But now that I'm here, surrounded by exotic trees and flowering gardens in a foreign palace, I wonder if perhaps I've been mistaken. I am an Israelite, yes, but he is Creator God of the whole world. And somehow, in the midst of unfortunate circumstances, there was always a moment, a hint of encouragement, something that reminded me that I did have a role to play, even in exile, a responsibility, and that this was, perhaps, part of his plan. I'll start at the beginning. I grew up in Susa, Persia's capital, and my mother and father had given me the name Hadassah, which in Hebrew means myrtle. It's a type of tree mostly used for decoration, nothing significant. But both of them died when I was quite young, my mother from illness and my father while serving in the king's army in the days when it wasn't uncommon for a Jew to be enlisted. So my older cousin Mordecai, who was an official at the king's gate, took me in and began calling me by my Persian name, Esther. Because he was an official, we lived in the citadel, the fortified part of Susa, where only the king's administration and household dwelled. With its elaborate marble architecture, elegant gardens, 70-foot columns, enormous walls. But outside of the walls was where I wanted to be. I spent many nights sitting at my cousin's feet, listening to him tell stories about our nation's history, how the Jews had for many years been united under Yahweh, the God of Israel, but then became divided and were thus easily invaded by the great Babylonian ruler, King Nebuchadnezzar, who completely destroyed Jerusalem and brought down everything, including the temple. The entire Jewish population was scattered, sent into exile, dispersed like seeds throughout the entire empire, first subject to the Babylonians, and now the Persians. Only recently had our people even been given permission to return to the holy city, but we remained in Susa, where intolerance for minorities was still quite common, and I harassed Mordecai for it, probably more than I should have. But I just didn't understand why we had to stay, trapped within another nation, surrounded by idolatrous peoples, forever hiding who we were, so that people wouldn't discover us. Jews were notorious in Persia. We were the scattered weeds, a people who could rise up in rebellion at any moment. And now that King Xerxes was on the throne, a man known for his fear of rebellion, I felt like there was no better time than the present to uproot, to flee Susa and regain safety within Judah with our own people. But Mordecai had placed his allegiance with the Persians, and he often had to remind me that it was our responsibility to be good citizens wherever the Lord planted us, to seek the welfare of every city that we entered into, even in exile, and pray on its behalf. So I prayed for a flood, maybe a siege, a violent earthquake, perhaps. It just seemed absurd to me to pray for the welfare of a nation that we weren't supposed to be a part of. They were not Yahweh's chosen people, we were. How was I supposed to serve Yahweh here, beneath the dirt of arrogant rulers and foreign oppression? Somehow, despite my grumbling, Mordecai continued to remain patient with me and assure me that we would not be abandoned, that Yahweh's purposes would yet be fulfilled, regardless of our circumstances. And although we trust in his providence, we still have a responsibility. But I remember the day that all hope of escape was lost. It was the 10th month, the start of the rainy season, and as I was walking through the markets, I heard word that an edict from the king had been sent out. So I rushed home to find Mordecai sitting at the table, reading the notice with an obvious look of anxiety. It commanded that the appointed officers in each of the 127 provinces were to gather every fair young virgin and send her immediately to the king's harem in Susa. He was looking for a new queen. See, 4 years prior to this, Queen Vashti had apparently displeased King Xerxes by refusing to appear before him at a royal feast in his palace gardens. He had wished to display her in front of all of his royal guests, but this was against normal customs, and Vashti refused to be presented in such a way. So out of humiliation, and in an intoxicated state of mind, he had the queen relieved of her position, and a royal letter was sent out so as to make an example of her and discourage other women from following her behavior. Vashti would be sent back to the harem house, never to come before the king again, and her royal position would be given to another who was better than she. Well, up until this point, the king had been planning his Greek campaign and engaging in battle out west. So now that he had recently returned, he was missing the queen and looking to fill the void. And apparently, none of his other 300 concubines would suffice. However, the last thing I needed was to become a part of his harem, to be forced behind another set of walls, trapped within a cella of a house, forced to act a certain way, walk a certain way, hide my face, and be at the king's beck and call whenever he found it convenient. I would never be able to leave Susa. I would never be allowed to marry or have a family. I already despised my circumstances. Why must I suffer even more exclusion? Mordecai had to sit me down and reason with me, again assuring me that we were under the protection of Yahweh, that I was to be strong and courageous and not be discouraged because he would be with me. But his eyes still showed concern as he reminded me not to make known my people or my kindred if I was taken into the king's palace, into his harem, as I would then be under the watchful eyes of the king's eunuchs. There was no telling how I would be treated if they found out that I was a Jew. Within the next few days, every young woman in the empire was brought to the palace in Susa to see Hege, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the harem. We all marched through the king's gate, where the officials were stationed, and I caught Mordecai's gaze as we walked past. The gate had been built by Darius, Xerxes' father, and it was a monumental sight to see. Four enormous towers surrounded the entrance, and impressive columns gazed down at us as we walked through the passageway that led into the palace complex. Once in the courtyard, we were all stationed in rows, and as Hege strolled through the hundreds, he looked up and down each item and ranked them according to his standards. My pulse quickened as he paused in front of me, and he stood there for so long I started to get nervous. But then he called to his attendants and commanded that they take me into the cosmetics room so that I could be given my tools and my food portions. I assumed this meant that I had either pleased him or that I just needed a lot more work than everyone else. Either way, it was highly depressing, as I would now undergo a 12-month, intense, beautifying period full of oils and spices and ointments to smooth out my skin, turn me into a walking fragment, and make me suitable for King Xerxes. All the other girls seemed to delight in being indulged and pampered within the king's palace, but I was not supposed to be here, and I prayed constantly that Yahweh would deliver me from this purposeless prison. Even though I could already feel my spirit emptying as the knowledge of becoming a permanent decoration was sinking in. My only relief was knowing that Mordecai was nearby and was daily coming from the king's gate and asking Hege how I was and what was happening to me. This gave me courage and reminded me to seek the welfare of those around me, despite my bitter circumstances. If nothing else, it gained me favor with Hege, and when the 12 months were finally coming to an end, I was told that I was to eagerly await my time when I would be brought before the king. When my turn came, I was informed that I could take something with me from the harem, an accessory of some kind, but I had no idea, so I simply asked Hege what he thought best for me to bring. This pleased him, and he gave me a beautiful arrangement of jewels for my head, and a flowered clip for my hair. And then with a nod, his attendants led me out of the harem house and down the palace corridors towards the king's inner chambers. As we walked, I couldn't help but notice all of the marble statues that lined the walkways. Each individual posed in a specific place, in exactly the proper manner, all displaying the same smooth surfaces, the same blank stares, the same lifeless eyes. They were pieces, molded to perfection, bought to be observed, perhaps admired, and then forgotten. When we reached the king's chambers, we stood before the large wooden doors and awaited the king's call. I held my breath as they started to open, and I was brought in to be presented before King Xerxes. The silence that followed made me nervous, and I worried that this fear would show on my face. But when I looked up, the king's eyes showed favor. And instead of sending me back to the harem house, he continued to desire my presence. Before I could even process what was happening, I was presented with the royal crown. And suddenly everything started changing. I was given new garments to wear, maids and attendants to wait on me, a place to dwell in the palace, and a royal feast was declared in my name for all of the king's court to attend. I was able to see Mordecai again. And although I knew he wouldn't be allowed to speak with me, his presence was a comfort, reminding me of who we were and to whom we truly owed our allegiance. Not long after this, Mordecai himself was able to gain the king's favor as he overheard two of the king's eunuchs plotting an assassination, and he immediately sent me word so that I could warn Xerxes. When the traitors were found out, Mordecai's name was recorded in the Book of Chronicles, and although he was never rewarded by the king himself, he gained quite the status among all of his fellow officers. All except one, Haman, who Mordecai once informed me was actually a descendant of Agag, king of the Amalekites, the infamous enemies of Israel. This man had recently been promoted to the position of vizier, and he now expected to be paid homage by all of his lower-ranking officials. Mordecai would, of course, refuse to pay him this honor for reasons that I understood, but Haman only grew in frustration. And I didn't even want to imagine what would happen if he found out that Mordecai was a Jew. Anyway, suddenly life had become much more eventful, with constant duties to uphold and gatherings to attend. But as the months went on, I still wasn't sure where to find myself in it all. Although I knew of my cousin's whereabouts, I was deprived of his counsel and had to constantly remind myself of everything he had taught me. The seasons changed, the days slipped by, and before I knew it, 5 years had passed. But only Yahweh knew what would soon interrupt my routine-filled existence. It was the first month, the month of Nisan, and as I was walking through the palace gardens, around the pavilion reserved for royal use, I was admiring all the new growth on the fruit trees and the exotic plants that decorated the gardens. And then I noticed that the myrtle trees were just beginning to blossom. And as I touched one of the star-shaped flowers, a few of my ladies-in-waiting came rushing up to me with distressed looks on their faces. They informed me that Mordecai had been found, weeping and mourning at the king's gate, making a public display of himself, wearing only sackcloth and ashes, which prevented him from being able to enter into the palace. Oh, completely confused, I rushed to get proper clothing sent out to him so that he could perhaps be granted an appearance with me. But he refused them. So I told one of the king's eunuchs to go to Mordecai and find out what was going on. When he returned, the look on his face showed that things were far from well. He informed me that all of Susa had been thrown into a state of confusion and chaos by a sudden decree from the king. Letters had been sent out to each of the 127 provinces instructing that on the 12th day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, every Jew in every city, young, old, woman, and child, was to be killed. And the entire nation completely destroyed. The whole nation decimated, led like sheep to be slaughtered. I can't even describe to you the shock and the grief of that moment. As I pictured every Jew in the empire receiving this news, falling to their knees, dressing themselves in sackcloth and ashes, crying out to Yahweh, why? Why was this happening? This wasn't just hardship or intolerance. This was complete annihilation. I was shown a copy of the written decree, and my eyes were drawn to the signature at the bottom, the marking of the king's signet ring, the stamp that had been given to Haman. He had found out from some of the servants that Mordecai was a Jew, and his arrogant lust for power scorned the idea of only killing Mordecai. No, he wanted to see all of Mordecai's people destroyed. So he manipulated the king, explaining that a certain nation scattered within the empire had different customs and didn't follow the proper laws. They were a minority group whose nationalism could provoke them to rise up in rebellion at any moment, which was, of course, not in the king's best interest. Xerxes was persuaded. And Haman even paid 10,000 talents of silver into the king's treasury to see this all through. The entire Jewish population had been weighed and purchased, only to be pushed out of existence. But even all this wasn't enough to prepare me for what I was about to hear next. Mordecai wished for me to go before the king and plead with him on behalf of our people. But I couldn't. I had no authority in the matter. I couldn't just wander into the king's chambers and speak with him whenever I wanted without being summoned. The consequence for that was to be put to death. So I sent word back to my cousin reminding him of this well-known fact. I had not been called. And in fact, I hadn't been called into the king's chambers for a month, whether his focus was on other things or I had perhaps lost his favor, I had no idea. Either way, it would be risking my life to appear before him without his prior approval. But then I received this note in return. Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, deliverance for the Jews will grow from somewhere else, but you and your father's seed will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Everything within me wanted to just crawl into a corner and forget that I was even in this position. Why? Why me? I hadn't even wanted to be here in the first place. But now I had to make a choice. I had been planted here. And now I was being summoned. Just to a higher calling than what I was used to. Every emotion within me screamed at me that I was insane and that I would certainly fail. But somehow, a spirit of obedience and purpose filled me and assured me that I was meant to believe otherwise. So I told Mordecai to gather all of the Jews in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf, praying to Yahweh and not eating or drinking for 3 full days, and myself and my attendants would do the same. After these 3 days, I would go before the king, even though it was against his law, and plead with him on our behalf. And if I perish, I perish. And I have never before experienced such fear, such uncertainty, or such anxiety as I did in those 3 days. But by the evening of the third, when I had reviewed the words I planned to say and made the arrangements that I needed to make, that same spirit of purpose again filled me and led me to begin my trek down the palace hallways and towards the king's inner courtyard. My heart pounding outside of my chest, I approached the entrance and then planted myself in the entryway, waiting moment by moment for the king to look up and see me standing there. When he finally did, everything within me seized up, and I naturally feared the worst. But although his face showed surprise, it displayed no discontent or disapproval, but rather relief and comfort, as if I was somehow a beacon of light to a darkened state of mind. He held out his golden scepter towards me, the sign that I was welcome. And as I exhaled an immense sigh of relief and came before him, he asked me, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled." I then asked the king that if it please him to let he and Haman come to a feast that I had prepared for them that evening, and there I would make known my request. Immediately, the king's face lit up, and within moments, he had sent for Haman so that the two could make their way to the outer courtyard, where I had had everything arranged. Once there, the men were surrounded by tall marble pillars and intricate and precious stones embedded in the mosaic flooring. I had had white cotton curtains hung up on purple and silver rods and then tied with cords of the finest linen. The men were entertained by the palace musicians and dined on the finest selections of foods from all over the empire. And afterwards, as they reclined on their silver couches, I had the attendants bring out the royal wine. But as the evening went on, it became obvious that the king was very much enjoyed Haman's presence and valued his company. And I started to think that this one feast may not suffice in gaining enough of the king's favor to present my request. Everything Haman did just made my jaw clench, and it was all I could do but keep from scowling at him the entire evening. But after some time, the king noticed my silence, and he set aside his wine glass, turned to me, and asked if I had a wish, and that it would be granted. And what was my request? Even to the half of his kingdom, it would be fulfilled. Everything within me wanted to just fall to my knees right then and there and plead with him on behalf of our people. But something stopped me and said, "Wait, be patient," that it was not yet the time. So instead, I answered the king that if it pleased his greatness to fulfill the wish that I had, to let he and Haman come to another feast, which I would prepare for them tomorrow, and there I would make known my request. Loving any reason for a feast, the king agreed. And as he left to retire, I watched a drunken Haman rise from his seat, trip over a shrub, and then stumble out of the palace courtyard, looking quite pleased with himself that he had gained such high favor with myself and the king. His arrogance made me so angry, and I struggled to understand why I had felt such a need to wait, and why I hadn't just accused him when I had the chance. But there were lives at stake, many lives. We were a people in desperate need of redemption, and perhaps my impatience would have only made matters worse. So, the following day, I hurried to make arrangements for the second feast, ensuring that this one would be even more elaborate than the former. But as I directed my attendants, a few of my ladies-in-waiting came rushing up to me with another urgent message from Mordecai. As if things weren't already chaotic enough, they informed me that Haman's hatred for my cousin had provoked him to build gallows that morning, 75 feet high, and he was now en route to speak with the king about having my cousin killed and put on public display. So without even thinking, I dropped everything, and I hurried back over to the king's chambers, and then nearly crashed into two of the king's eunuchs as they were walking out, carrying the Book of Chronicles. Confused, I asked the men what they were doing, and they informed me that the king had not slept well the night before and had therefore desired to be reminded of all the good deeds that had been done in his favor. As the men continued down the hallway, I crept up to the entrance just in time to overhear the king asking Haman for his opinion on what should be done for the man with whom the king delights to honor. There was a pause, and then Haman gave this response, of course, assuming that the king was talking about him. "Well, your highness, let royal robes be brought out, which the king has worn, and the horse on which the king has ridden, and let a royal crown be set on this man's head. Let your most royal attendants then dress this man and lead him about on the square of the city, proclaiming his honor to all who are there." The purpose of Haman's visit obviously hadn't been addressed yet, so I waited. And as my mind wandered back to my recent collision with the eunuchs, I suddenly remembered that Mordecai's name had been written in the Book of Chronicles not too many years earlier. And before I could even anticipate what was about to happen, the king suddenly commanded Haman to go and do exactly as he had just described to Mordecai the Jew, who was seated at the king's gate, leaving out nothing that he had just mentioned. Tears of relief started rushing down my cheeks, and I had to run and hide around the corner as Haman left the king's presence with a look that could make a statue cry. It was then that I was thankful that I hadn't exposed his plot the night before. Just to witness the reaction of my cousin as he received this royal treatment from the man who had sought out to kill him. To see him lifted from the dust and raised to such a high seat of honor, it was also joyous. I almost entirely forgot about the feast that I still needed to prepare. So I hurried back to the gardens to continue with the arrangements. By the time evening came around, I was exhausted and had grown so nervous I could barely eat, remembering again that the fate of my people rested on this event. We were facing death, and all I could do is remember that our circumstances were not mine to control, and our fate not the king's to judge. We were Yahweh's people, his chosen offspring, and he would not have taken us here to just abandon us. And as that affirmation settled over me, the king once again set aside his wine glass, turned to me, and asked, "What is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted. And what is your request, even to the half of my kingdom? It shall be fulfilled." Now, by this point, it seemed a lot easier to just ask for half of his kingdom. But after everything that had already happened, I just couldn't keep my emotions together any longer, and I fell to my knees before him, and through bursts of tears, I pleaded, "O king, if I have found favor in your sight, let my life be granted me for my wish, and my people for my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be killed, to be destroyed, and to be annihilated." And then I turned my face to the ground and let my tears fall to the floor at his feet. When I looked up, the king's face had turned a fiery red, and he rose from his seat and demanded, "Who is he? Where is he who has dared to do this?" I then pointed to the man whose face had by now turned stone white. "A foe and an enemy," I said, "this wicked Haman." And in a fit of rage, the king yelled for his eunuchs and then stormed off into the palace gardens to compose himself. But then I was left alone with Haman, who by this point was desperately begging for his life, flinging himself onto the couch beside me at my feet where I was seated, and something one never does to the queen. Well, within moments, the king had returned, and his anger flared even more as he yelled, "Will he even assault the queen in my own presence, in my own house?" And before he could blink, Haman's face was covered, and he was bound and dragged out of the palace courtyard by the king's eunuchs. One of the young men then came up to the king and informed him about the gallows that Haman had built that morning for Mordecai, the Jew, who had saved the king's life. And without waiting a single beat, the king commanded, "Hang him on that." So the very instrument that Haman had intended to use for the destruction and disgrace of my cousin was now being used for his own disgrace. And I then took the opportunity to inform the king that Mordecai was in fact my cousin. So he sent for Mordecai, and he gave him the signet ring that had been taken from Haman. Together we then pleaded with the king to revoke the letters that had been sent out for the destruction of the Jews. But he shook his head and informed us that an edict written in the name of the king and sealed with his stamp could not be revoked. So there was nothing we could do to stop the attack from happening. However, he did give us permission to write a new edict, one that could somehow offset the first one and give our people a fighting chance. So immediately we sent for the king's scribes, and Mordecai got to work at writing a new edict, one which declared that on the 13th day of the 12th month, Jews in every city were given permission to gather and defend themselves and to defeat any armed force that might attack them. See, in this way, Haman's armed mercenaries would no longer be under the protection of the government, and the Jewish defense would not be seen as rebellion. The letters were then stamped and sent out by couriers mounted on the swiftest horses to each of the 127 provinces, informing the Jews that they could be ready on that day to battle against their enemies. And when that day arrived and evening fell, the king informed me that the Jewish people had defeated almost 500 men in Susa alone. When all was finished throughout the empire, our people had been delivered from a total of 75,000 men. Men who had been hired by Haman and funded by his 10,000 talents. We had been delivered. Our seed would yet continue. Abraham's seed would continue. And all of Susa rejoiced on our behalf. Mordecai was placed second in rank to King Xerxes and gained a high honor among all of our Jewish brothers. Because, even in the most dire circumstances, he had not abandoned his post, but had obeyed the Lord's command to remain where he was. And by encouraging me to do the same, we had both been in a position to be used, to be instruments for Yahweh's redemptive purposes. So, now here I sit. Years later, in the palace gardens, reflecting and remembering. It is now the month of Elul, the summer season. And I'm always particularly drawn to the myrtle trees at this time of year and their fine abundance of fruit. Because in this fruit, there are many seeds. And although these seeds may get scattered to new places, rooted in foreign soils, they will still continue to produce the same fruit. A fruit through which Yahweh will continue to reveal his purposes restore his world, and unfold his redemptive plan. And who knows what someday one of these seeds might do.